Well, I'm glad you came again. And facing probably the most, hard to say, most significant event in the 20th century. That's really saying a lot, but I'm trying to think what would be for Christianity and so forth. We're talking about science switching over, you know, switching a philosophy over from a Bible-based idea to a science-based idea. I don't know what would be more significant in the 20th century than the Scopes monkey trial. I don't know if what would be more written about. In fact, I've thought even that probably it is probably second only to the Reformation in terms of the impact that it made. And it's interesting from so many facets, and that's what this is kind of a difficult lesson to get ready because there's so many trails to run down, and you don't know that you can't run down all of them. So you have to kind of pick the big ones and don't have the time really to do that. So I'm going to give it a shot. Maybe I got too much material here, but it is a significant point, and kind of what comes out of it is what doesn't come out of it, which is the news, I guess, in a sense, by itself. So I have it called Science on Trial, the Scopus Monkey Trial, and it's kind of what it is. And rather than tell you what I'm going to tell you, I'm just going to tell you, okay? So some years ago, maybe 4 years ago, somebody gave Gil this front page of the New York Times dated July 12, 1925, and it's actually a New York Times front page story 2 days after the trial started. The trial started on the 10th, so that's a Friday, so we'd have Saturday, probably didn't have a trial, and Sunday, of course, didn't have a trial. So we basically have the beginning of the trial, and we have the front page newspaper coverage of it. And so I read some of it, and finally show some of it to you. And there's another section that printed some of William Jennings Bryan, not some of, all of William Jennings Bryan, what was going to be his summation speech. And I said, wow, is it long? I mean, it's longer than Gil's messages. So, in fact, I was gonna, you know, do a, you know, copy the words or count the words and to kind of determine how long it would take to read. But I read it last night. It took me a long time to read it. You can get it's online. You don't have to have the paper, but it's, and I checked, that's what the paper had. Actually had it just exactly like, I didn't check every word, but it started out the same article. So that was on the Herald Tribune. I think it was New York Tribune. It got bought up, so it changed the names. But this is the Times article, and we have Osborne states the case for evolution. He's on the left, and he writes a little paragraph, which I'm going to show you, and then we have Ryan on the right. Sort of has a somewhat of a rebuttal for it. So anyway, someone gave Gil that newspaper, and I've had it laying on my credenza ever since he gave it to me in my office here. I said, someday I'm going to teach this stuff and I'm going to need it. And it's so fragile, you dare not put it away. You know, it's in a, you know, kind of a plastic sheath. But so tonight's the night we get to use it after all these years. And it comes apart in four pieces. The page comes, just like it shows here, this is two, and the bottom half is two pieces, so it comes in four pieces, and it just comes apart. Well, that's almost 100 years old and not been particularly well preserved. So anyway, it's fun to have something from some authentic piece, although the information is available elsewhere as well. This is Osborne, the guy on the left, writes, every great anthropologic and paleontologic discovery fits into its proper place, enabling us to gradually fill out one after another the great branching lines of human ascent and to connect with these branches different phases of industry and art. Remember, he's the evolutionist guy here. This gives us a double meaning of interpretation, archaeological and anatomical. While many branches and links in the chain remain to be discovered, 1925, we are now in a position to predict with great confidence not only what the various branches will be like, but where they will be mostly, where would they most likely be found. And I'm still waiting. You know, from that statement, we still hear the same talk, waiting for the missing link. Well, actually, it's missing links. All right, so he's very confident. We are now confident that we don't know all the answers, but we're confident that we will come to them soon. Brian says why these men would destroy the Bible on evidence that would not convict an actual criminal of a misdemeanor. They found a tooth in the sandpit of Nebraska with no other bone around it, and from that one tooth decided it was the remains of the missing link. It's called the Nebraska Man. Remember him? They have a queer idea about age, too. They find a fossil when they are asked how old it is. They say that they can't tell without knowing what rock it is in. And when they are asked how old the rock is, they say, well, they can't tell unless they know how old the fossil is. Pretty good rebuttal, I thought. In fact, his multi-page, it takes at least an hour to read his rebuttal, is very well done. In fact, I'll say this because I probably forget to say it. I think my mind, to some extent, was a little bit salted by the stuff I've read about the trial, and I put Brian a little bit down a few notches. You know, after all, he's kind of a country hick. But he's not. He doesn't. Outstanding job in apologetics. In fact, if you it's online, I'll show you how to get it. You might want to read it. He does an excellent job of defending biblicalism, creationism, and he does it in a very, very nice way. So anyway, so that to say, he's just not some yokel that fell off the pickup truck. I didn't think he was, but I have some of these pictures here just to run through them. You know that his not his birthplace. The birthplace was not here, but this is where he lived. He lived two places in Lincoln, one at the Bryan Hospital. It's still standing there on the right, and the stairs have been moved to from the west to the south. This is the original orientation, and they filled it in. The porch was filled in, and the other one is Billy's. Some of you have eaten there. Have you eaten there? Anybody? Anybody? All right. So that's also home where he lived, and I couldn't find the dates on it. It's all actually either, and also is the home of one of the vice presidents that came from Nebraska. I think his name is Dawes. Come and confirm that. So, all right. So he lived there, too. So we have two houses in Lincoln where William, I'm going to get his name messed up, Williams Jennings Bryan lived. On the left is the courthouse, which is still standing and is now, of course, a monument, I'm sure. In the middle is the school where the Scopes teacher taught evolution. And then we have these defendant lawyers walking underneath, read your Bible. That's a nice sign. And then we have a flagpole of half-mast because Brian dies what, 5 or 6, 7 days, something like that, after the trial, and the flag is flown at half-mast. And then here are some of the defense trial attorneys pictured. The jury is being sworn in. I'll tell you later, there's they're all farmers. No, 10 were farmers. 11 were churchgoers, so, you know, they're a highly religious area. And we have the scene from the trial. We have Darrow and Brian talking together in the circle. And at the end, they moved the trial outside. There were as many as 1,000 people in this small room, and they really worried about the floor collapsing. And so they moved it outside for more room. And I think they have maybe as many as 5,000 outside. It was hot, so good reason to go outside. So that's what we have there. And we have other carnival things that they had around the trial. Many people come from many places in the United States just to see what was happening. So there's the modern-day look of the courthouse. Prequel, that which happens before. I want to remind you that we're always talking about something that has a spiritual root here. So one of the consistent themes of history is the saga of the contest of the wills. The contest is fundamentally of our understanding of history. That is essential to understand history's resolution. We need to know where it's going, and we have to understand this contest of the wills is at the base of this. When God said, I am, Jesus said it, but we understand that's God, but it is man who, created by God, said, I will. This sets up the drama of the wills. And a study of history is, in its ontological formation, in the beginning, a contest of the wills. And we see it broken out before us. There are times in history when this contest is on display in the most simple terms. We have David and Goliath as one such example. We have the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness as another one. And the temptation of Jesus in the Garden of Eden, a Garden of Gethsemane, is probably the most personal and the most intense contest of the wills. In our present series of Christian history, it is in itself framed as a contest of the wills. in the contest of the David and Goliath, where there was a clear winner and loser, not a verdict that could be spun or confused or reversed, God actually won, period. Everybody that was there had the same eyes. All the Israelites and all the Philistines understood the same thing. God won. However, in the resolution of the Scopes monkey trial, it is a bit more confusing. In the end, the Scopes trial was ruled out of court, left the parties too exhausted to fight again. Even the social verdict was left in question. Although the legal question was settled in a guilty plea by Scopes in a quick end, it did not quiet the pundit's voice attempting to discredit the I Am. Yet Edward Larson, author of Summer of the Gods, said not a single newspaper editorial at the time determined it was a decisive event, either killing the anti-evolutionary crusade or a tremendous victory propelling it. To deal with the trial in 45 minutes, as we have to, is an impossible task. There are just too many facets in an eight-day event to investigate. So for our study, one beware that the issues of the trial were perceived by many Christians as the roadblock towards a Christianized nation. This prevails the not only the trial, but the climate. And we're going to remind you of some of the things we've already learned. But without this climate, this kind of threat would be impossible to imagine. I cannot imagine that a Scopes monkey trial would occur today. There's no desire on anybody's part to do it. No one's defending anything. No organization. It's just something you wouldn't do. That day was different. Remember, the decades leading to the trial were days when the unified Protestant church was feeling the pressure of fracturing. They felt their unification of Protestants coming apart. In fact, by 1925, the fracture was real, and the fractured element, I should really do this reverse, but I'm not going to do it. The fractured element is the evangelicals, the fundamentalists, because I really think they're the ones that didn't fracture off as the liberals have fractured off, but I'm going to use the figure anyway. The fractured element off of the mainline churches fought back with all means available. And that was basically the public opinion and the use of the law. In the period 1923 to 1924, Riley, remember him from the Minneapolis pastor, he ended up being president of Northwestern, not the one we play football with, but the one that's in Minnesota. In the period of 1923 to 24, Riley spent a great deal of time crusading against evolution in Tennessee, which he viewed as essentially fertile ground for anti-evolution legislation. Memphis on the west is a hotbed of fundamentalism and a Baptist stronghold, and the leading paper was stridently anti-evolutionist. Now, across the state, Baptists accounted for half of the population. Riley's effort to make evolution one of the hot issues in the 1924 state election. Next wrong one. When the fate of the Tennessee anti-evolution bill hung in doubt, we talked about that last week, how it was brought up, William Riley and his major allies, Billy Sunday, Frank Norris, Williams Jennings Bryan, roused the faithful to write letters and send telegrams to the undecided legislators. Without them, the fundamentalist victory would never have happened. Now, I mentioned Frank Norris, just to give you a little bit of the climate of the day. At the height of Norris's career came in the 1920s when he became the leader of the fundamentalist movement in Texas by attacking the teaching of the hell-born, Bible-destroying, deity-of-Christ-denying German rationalism known as evolution, probably tied to Schleiermacher, at Baylor University. In his 1926 sermon series, Romanism, Norris attacked Mayor Meacham of Fort Worth, who he accused of misappropriating funds for the Roman Catholic causes. The same year, Norris killed lumberman Dexter Elliott Chips, a friend of Meacham, in Norris's church office. Norris claimed Chips was threatening his life, and when Norris was tried for murder, he was acquitted on grounds of self-defense. We're talking serious stuff here. And he was a fundamentalist. When evolution proponents orchestrated their challenge to the New Tennessee Law in the spring of 25, Riley plotted the law's defense. By chance, the WFCA, that's the World Fundamentalist Christian Association, held its 1925 annual meeting in Memphis, and its feature speaker was Brian. Brian commented on the upcoming trial in his address. He said, "I noticed that a case is on the docket for trial involving the evolutionary statute in your state. I hope, certainly hope it will be upheld." Well, staying in Memphis after the conference, Riley and other WFCA leaders decided to write to William Jennings Bryan, who, 30 years removed from courtroom action, but widely perceived as the fundamentalist movement's greatest orator, to join the prosecution team on the association's behalf. Now, let's see here that Williams Bryan was not the lead attorney. It seems like he was. He's always pitted against Darrell, but somebody else was the lead attorney. Just to let you know that. The name of our attorney for this trial, William Jennings Bryan, and pledge him whatever support is needful to secure equity and justice and to conserve the righteous law of the Commonwealth of Tennessee, read the resolution. On May 13, Riley telegrammed Bryan, asked him to go to Dayton. Bryan, on a speaking tour, wired his acceptance back from Pittsburgh. So Bryan was a three-time Democratic candidate for president of the United States, served as Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson, resigned his position in the USA's involvement in World War I. He was probably not a conscientious objector, but he was a pacifist. A lot of people were isolationists during that war, and he was one of those. Bryan, well known as an orator, trained as a lawyer, and an unequivocal anti-evolutionist, and we might even call him a Bible thumper. I put a book cover up here. Steph gave it to me, I don't know who gave it to me. One of you guys gave it to me last week, and it's really a good book. And I don't want to read the whole book because it's too much about Bryan. But the introduction is worth the book itself, and the closing is really great too. So, "Godly Hero" by Michael Kazan would be a great read, and I've used some of his stuff in our lesson tonight. Well, it is tempting to pause with Bryan as a teachable figure in the stuff that we've talked about here. We've discussed moralism that precipitated the Civil War, fomented by the preaching of Charles Finney. And I'm going to say that Bryan is a quintessential example of moralistic person that has been formed from this period. We have also discussed Schleiermacher as one who stripped the death, burial, and resurrection out of Christianity, leaving the shell of Christianity, which is left the shell as a moralism, which is what was promoted by Finney. Remember, all this was like stripping Christ out of Christmas, but retaining the great spirit of the holiday season as a sterling achievement. Now, Bryan, born a year before the war, Bryan was a quintessential moralist product of the age, and the job for them was to clean up society. We are reminded that the Protestants united as Christians and made few doctrinal distinctions. That's how it's difficult for us to read them from our point of view. We make doctrinal distinctions. They were less likely to. So Bryan is considered a fundamentalist because of his moral fundamentalism, not his doctrinal convictions. One of his failures in the trial was to allow a deep time for earth. Bryan was caught off guard, was not a theologian's fundamentalist, couldn't really deal with what the Bible said consistently because he was just basically practical moralist, not a theologian. While mixing doctrinal fundamentalists and moral fundamentalists, few then failed to draw the obvious distinctions. Now, notice before we had Riley's use of these leaders without distinction. Billy Sunday, Frank Morris, William Jennings Bryan, you know, they're all doing the same thing, but there's quite a bit of difference between these guys. It was easy then to miss the distinction between preaching temperance and the gospel. For them, it kind of looked alike. Are they not related after all? For many of his correspondents, Bryan was not merely a favorite politician. They believed him to be a godly hero who preached that the duty of a true Christian was to transform a nation that would be plagued by the arrogance of wealth and the pain of inequity. Now, I look on the top here, I wrote, we ought to see liberal distinctions. And we see this very clearly with Brian. There's no doubt where he came down on liberalism or conservatism. Remember, all this was before or about the time when communism was coming on strong in Russia, but no one really knew what was happening there. There was a lot of thought about socialism as being the answer to the trouble, because we have this equity and wealth, and we have the suffrage of people that, you know, that capitalism produces. So there is this idea to try something else. Seems like we slipped the cog. We're back to it 100 years later, aren't we? Got a new generation, don't we? Or two. It could only mean a radically progressive interpretation of the gospel. You know, how do you interpret the gospel? I keep wanting to say that to myself. How do you interpret the gospel? It is what it is. But you can interpret the gospel mean something else, and the liberals are ones to do this. So that, as the Pennsylvanian phrased it, our gaping social wounds may be healed and our class distinction leveled. Again, liberal distinctions here. Mass appeal lifted Brian to the top rank in American leaders despite his failures at the ballot box. Only Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson had a greater impact on politics and political culture during the years of reform that began in the middle of the 1890s and lasted until the early 1920s. That's a big mouthful. Brian's creed buried democracy and pietism in a romantic gospel that borrowed equally from Jefferson and Jesus. You may know the difference. A leveling faith, no differences, leveling faith that dominated the nation's religious life since the Great Awakening. I'm glad this guy said that, because that's what I've been saying. So I think it helps me to see somebody else say the same thing. Helps me. The leveling faith had dominated the nation's religious life since the Second Great Awakening of the early 19th century, which spawned thousands of new Protestant churches and made the passion of evangelicalism, question mark whether that's the right term here, but that's what he used, the common discourse of most Americans. We saw ourselves all as one group. We're all Christians going to different churches, but we're all basically the same. Now, I know there were some people in that group that didn't think that way, but the group felt that way. There were some earlier adopters that got out of this like 1900. But by 1925, you know, we'll find out that most will leave because they finally understand what's happening. The idea that anyone, regardless of learning or social background, could come to Christ dovetailed with the belief that equal rights blazoned in the Declaration of Independence. So this Christianity and America gets blended together as almost inseparable. And to some extent, I can see why some might say that, but we've got to be very careful with that. Now, Brian yoked the legitimacy of nearly every major reform for which he campaigned to Jeffersonian principles. In a practical sense, Jefferson was more important to him than Jesus. After all, the Son of God had never uttered an opinion about the protective tariff, the gold standard, or corporate power. But Jefferson was a fierce partisan warrior and thus left an inexhaustible legacy of opinions and principles for those of a similar ideological persuasion, which Brian was one. The Women's Christian Temperance Union, the largest women's group in the nation, claimed that its work to close down the saloons, improve prison conditions, shelter prostitutes, and support labor unions for women were all examples of God in politics. The altruistic sisterhood, wrote one member, continually opens its windows towards Jerusalem. Notice the allegorical wording here. Opens towards Jerusalem and portrays the government to make it easy for the people to do right and hard for them to do wrong. From Colorado to the Carolinas, rebel lecturers told their audiences that God has promised to hear the cry of the oppressed and preach that no man in this nation can live a consistent Christian life unless he threw himself into the agrarian insurgency. I guess that's the poor farmer. This is a social gospel from below, and it produced its own breed of prophets. The journalist Henry George predicted that the enactment of his single tax on unimproved land proposed in his popular 1879 tome, Progress and Poverty, would bring about the accumulation of Christianity and Augustine's The City of God on Earth, with its walls of jasper and its gates of pearl. And I remind you, this again is postmillennialism. Now, a few years earlier, on Civil War time, Henry Ward Beecher's pastor, Brooklyn's Plymouth Church, was a gifted apostle of Christianity as good news. Christianity was good news. The former abolitionist refused to dwell on the original sin, divine punishment, or the need for moral discipline. He said, "I'm apt to look on the bright side of things and take a cheerful look at life." He admitted, Beecher thought, it his mission to install a gospel of love in place of grim doctrines on which his own congregational, originally Puritan, remember, denomination had been formed, so far off the plantation. He is. Samuel P. Jones, a Georgian Methodist, traveled around the South during the Gilded Age, wisecracking his case for prohibition and inerrancy of Scripture. So we say somebody today, they believe in the inerrancy of Scripture, he's almost like a fundamentalist. We know for sure, because everybody else isn't. But those days, they stood up for the Scripture. Brian's going to stand up for Scripture strongly. The leading revivalist of this period was, his name was Sledgehammer, this Jones. And his rhetorically was opposite of Dwight Moody, who in his 280 pounds wreath and a full beard and encased in a dark suit looked like a conservative businessman or politician, a teetotaling, cigar-abstaining Ulysses S. Grant. Well, Beecher and Moody, now I know if I'd say it quite like this, so I'm going to let him say it. Beecher and Moody had their theological differences, but they fashioned a common style, relaxed, sentimental, open to all, that resembled that of the barnstorming politician. There was a marked decrease in conflicts between the major evangelical denominations during the Gilded Age, I'll repeat that third time, and such preachers contribute to and benefit from the new ecumenism, didn't see each other as enemies so much. Beecher Moody could transcend sectarian rivalries by speaking simply as Christians, eager to point out the path to a joyful life and eventual salvation to anyone who would listen. Which church an individual belonged to seemed little significance. I question that a little bit, as long as it was a Protestant one, but I understand the spirit of it would be true. Okay, this new culture of popular religion, called moralism, skirted the grand controversy between faith and science. You know, in between this shift from faith to science, it's not all clean line. We talked about that. And this moralism had little to say about the second coming. It just wasn't a big issue. Now, if you're in the dispensational stripe, that wouldn't be true. So, well, this is a general statement. Well, Darwinism led theologians to either shudder at or guardedly welcome what one historian called the breakup of an intellectual system that had endured from the beginning of the European civilization, which means a Christian-based intellectualism. You know, remember, all the early scientists were Christians, quote, quote. Most Protestants seemed comfortable both with a supernatural faith and with the rigors and pleasures of modern America. And I remind you, or us, that preaching against sin is different than preaching the remedy for sin. They preached against sin, but they didn't preach a remedy for sin. That's what the gospel needs to be preached. Well, from such sources grew a romantic gospel for the common American, which Brian would echo repeatedly throughout his career. He and the millions of his fellow citizens embraced a democratic bargain, whether they preferred the deathless phrases of Jefferson and his disciples, the messianic rage of labor and the farmer's activist, the ministerial salvation of a troubled mass public, or a combination of all three. The injunction, the voice of the people is the voice of God, worked equally well in both directions. And when I read that, I remember seeing our own state capitol. Do you know it says that very thing? I remember saying this years ago. The salvation of the state is the watchfulness of the citizen. That's what he's saying. Same thing. So we have this idea. This was what capital built in the 30s, 20s? 1924. So it's from this period of time. So he depended on the people, not God. The people are going to take care of us. All right. So here are a couple of websites, which if you can, the way you get to them is look at them on the website when I put it up, and you can copy down. I really thought they were helpful on our discussion. Some are not. A lot of them are. But I like these. Okay. Interesting. Bryan was the first leader of a major party to argue for permanently expanding the power of the federal government to serve the welfare of the ordinary Americans from the working and the middle class. What's that called? That's called liberalism today. All right? That's what's being promoted and has been promoted on down the days. I want you to know where it comes from. It came from our own city. With the backing of his followers, he preached that the national state should counter the overweening, is that the right word? Could be weaning, could be overwhelming, power of the banks and industrial corporation by legalizing strikes, subsidizing farmers, taxing the rich, yay, yay, banning private campaign spending, yay, yay, and outlawing the liquor trust. He did more than any other man between the fall of Grover Cleveland and the election of Woodrow Wilson to transform his party from a bulwark of laissez-faire into a citadel of liberalism we identify with Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his ideological descendants. His one great flaw was to support, with a studied lack of reflection, the abusive system of Jim Crow. Now, this is one of the things that we just don't want to talk about, but the Democrats have been the racist slave party from the get-go. If you ever watched any of Dinesh D'Souza's stuff, he makes the point that there was not one Republican that had a slave, not one. You prove it to me, bring it to me, and I'll eat my words. So this is something we've been told differently about. Anyway, I just want you to be aware that he was in that camp. A view that he shared until late 1930s by nearly every white Democrat. Herbert Hoover once snapped that the New Deal was Bryanism under new words and methods, which proves that bitterness need not impair one's historical judgment. Now, I did that, a little extended picture of Bryan, to show that what kind of man mounted the national stage as the voice of the prosecution against ungodliness. The stage of the monkey trial was international and the sensation of the century with a notoriety just short of the Reformation. I don't believe there's been a comparison since. So we think of the whole event. There are questions about the wisdom of the whole matter. And maybe we'll talk about this a little bit more next week. You know, it's sort of like you do the thing and then you get a little editorial comment about the whole thing. There's lots of things to talk about here. So there's some questions about the wisdom of the whole thing. Even if there were no flaws in the people and the events and the outcome, let's say it was done perfectly, we're reminded of the disadvantage the courtroom has for the faithful Christian because the enemy is formidable. And remember in 1 Corinthians we had that quote earlier, does any one of you dare to go to the law before the unrighteous? James 2, 6, another one. So a perfect storm happens. With the collision of opposites, the cold and hot and weather, we just seen that in our state this last spring, winter. In the Scopes trial, we have the hottest defense against the coldest prosecution, vice versa, if you will. The defense mounted by the ACLU, which was in heat to try its muscle, killing Christianity, met by the self-assured, even a self-righteous, moralist prosecution team. The news created by a sensation-seeking press was a recipe for the disaster of the century. Well, we have had extended look at Bryan as the teaching opportunity because of what was generated in the culture of Finneyism. Sometimes it is called the Golden or the Gilded Age after the Civil War. Remember that Schleiermacher, the core events of the gospel, death, burial, and resurrection were removed as offensive to Christianity. It was this emasculated version of Christianity called moralism that prevailed in the minds of Bryan and perhaps Riley. Now, I don't know that Riley was there because he really was a fundamentalist, not just in practice. So as a prequel to the trial, it seems like the influence of evolution, this is really a surprising thing. Before the trial, it seemed like the influence of evolution was heading for a natural death. because of low support for it. Remember, we're talking 50 years since Darwin and 25, 30 years since The Descent of Man by Darwin. So the plausibility of Darwinism was stretched to incredulity. People said, what? Come on. In the 20th century, it appears to have lost its appeal. It offered nothing, it really offered nothing superior to the biblical answer. The expectations of eugenics and racial supremacy, I might add white supremacy, a logical application of natural selection was just too inhumane. And remember, it kept on going and was picked up by others like Adolf Hitler. All right, so you can see there was a distaste in the mouth for this. So sometimes think about if they would have just not done this, would this have just gone away? I don't know. Probably not, but all right. It would appear that William Riley encouraged the states to pass these anti-evolutionary laws. And I say he was unwittingly participating in moralism, expecting that the states would cut off Darwinism. But in that action, the I will tiger in the atheistic ACLU was awakened. You know, better to leave him alone than wake him up. They woke him up. Now, Paul warned the Corinthians that they would be drugged to court. Here, the WCFA was inviting the world to drag them into court. A court is not the place where perfect righteousness will ever find satisfaction. So here's the lesson. The lesson is that if grass-rooted Christian influence simply by their presence does not stop the advance of unrighteousness, a state law will do nothing except antagonize the opposition. And we have another example in Prohibition. So if we don't do it by sitting here and being Christians without the organization, it's not going to happen. Okay, that's that side. Now the left. The ACLU funding the defense had not secured an attorney. When Clarence Darrow, hearing of Brian's involvement as part of the prosecution, volunteered to defend Scopes without any charge, the ACLU preferred a less controversial attorney, but in this case only, Scopes' wishes were honored. Now, maybe ACLU was formed 1920, so they've been 5 years old. They really haven't had a case to put them on the map. And by the way, they were infiltrated, I understand, with a lot of communistic ideas or people, which were then somewhat taken out later on. I'm not sure if they're not back again. Okay, Clarence Darwin, agnostic, always had been interested in criminal law, in part because of his acceptance of psychology's theories involving the role of determinism in human behavior, which means that there's always some outside force making you do what you do that determines outside, not from me. For this reason, he was a bitter opponent of capital punishment because these are victims. You don't put victims to death, viewing it as an inhumane practice. He began a new career, major career, as a criminal lawyer. A liberal lawyer who defended those charged with serious crime. He believed that criminals were people led by outside factors, such as personality and environment, etc., and they were then led into these unlawful acts. We have today the ideas of psychology from Freud, psychoanalysis, things like that. I go, psychoanalysis is me telling you what's wrong with you. That's what it is. Gland malfunctions, who knows about that? The chemistry of the body, it's complicated. Behaviorism, all that kind of stuff, and he bought into all this stuff. Psychology was fresh those days, and therefore the person that did the killing really wasn't responsible at all, was the environment or things around him. By the spring of 1925, Darrow was a controversial trial lawyer because of those he successfully defended. In 1924, he defended Leb and Leopold, young men, of exceptional high IQ, 210 and 180, that's pretty high, who had killed Bobby Franks for the purpose of committing the perfect crime. These smart guys are going to do the perfect crime. But the boys got caught right away. You know, it was no perfect crime. It's kind of a dilemma for the evolutionists. How could these bright boys be evil? After all, evolution is supposed to be improving things, aren't they? Well, in Chicago, where the crime occurred, was incensed by the brutality of the crime and by those two rich boys. The community wanted death by hanging. Darrow defended the young man, an expert psychological witness, plus a liberal and anti-death penalty judge, won life sentences with recommendation of no parole. Darrow was a good defense lawyer, but justice was not always served with him. Well, anyway, Darrow volunteered his services, paid his own expenses to defend Scopes. The ACLU was concerned about his unpopular reputation, but John Scopes won her Darrow. Now, Darrow was interested in putting Christian religion, which he considered a slave religion, in its place, and to allow free thought and academic liberty in the public schools. So he had an agenda. But, as we know, free thought, academic freedom, is a one-way street. In reality, there is no free thought allowed, nor academic freedom, except that which is approved by the establishment. Okay, now we have the trial. We have Brian, we also have the judge here, who apparently was an evangelical, God-fearing man who goes to church. Brian preaches the sermon on Sunday morning in the Methodist church, and the judge sitting on the front row. So, you know, they're kind of together on this. Now, I don't know if I want to go through all this, but you know how a courtroom is set up. You got the judge. If I can do this real quick here, you got the judge sitting up here. You got the witness, court reporter, jury, plaintiff, defense, and the hoi polloi. They come to watch. All right. So then we have, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm going to have to wing my way through this. So usually the way it goes, jury selection, you have opening statements by the prosecution, defense. You have the prosecution presents the charge. Witnesses are brought, evidence are brought, cross-examine the defense. Then the defense gets a chance to put on its witnesses and its case and its evidence. They're cross-examined. Then we have closing arguments, prosecution, defense, and then the jury delivers a verdict. Okay, and you go home, all in 20 minutes. All right, so we have on the prosecution, we have these are the lawyers. I'm not sure I'm going to stop and go through these guys, but because of time, that's one group. And this is the group on the other side, the defense lawyers on the other side. And then we have the 12 men that are in the jury with the judge sitting on the courthouse steps. So 12 men, mostly middle-aged, 10 farmers, 11 were churchgoers. In 9 minutes, returned as instructed. Judge will instruct them. A verdict of guilty, and I'll explain why that is. Later learned that 11 of them had never heard of the theory of evolution. Now, that's incredible to me. 11 of them never heard of the theory of evolution. They're sitting in judgment of a case about evolution. Tennessee? Well, I don't know. So these are the characters, the two judges, two attorneys, and then we have Scopes. And we start out, I'm going to just hit the high points here. This is, I think, 8-day trial. So the first thing Darrow does is try to quash the whole idea. So Darrow moves to quash the indictment by arguing that the law is foolish and meant to destroy liberty. States should give no preference to liberty, you know, separated church and state, all that kind of stuff. And the judge hears it, and what does he do? He overrules it. End of it. That's his case, basically. So the defense's goal was not to win an acquittal. They all admitted he had done it, but he still pled innocent. But rather to obtain a declaration of to a higher court, preferably the United States Supreme Court, where the law could be overturned, forbidding the teaching of evolution as unconstitutional. The goal, however, would not be realized in this trial and would stand for another 43 years till it was overturned in Arkansas. Okay, so the prosecution presents witnesses. I've read 7 witnesses. I've read 4, so somewhere. In 2 days, 7 student witnesses for the prosecution confirmed that Scopes had indeed taught evolution. In fact, the Scopes had even took these guys aside and gave them a special lesson on evolution so that they would really know that they've been taught evolution. There was not supposed to be any giving on this, that he did teach them evolution. And he adds on one more witness, and then Darrow cross-examines. It was a gentle cross-examination with a little cynicism in his voice, but that was that step. And that pretty well rests the prosecution. So the defense comes and brings its side, so Darrow brings 12 expert witnesses, scientists, theologians, arguing the law is unreasonable and improper exercise of authority over education, blah, 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 blah. But before this is heard, the judge allows it because he kind of wants to hear what he has to say, but he has the jury removed from the courtroom. So the jury doesn't hear the arguments from these 12 guys because they really weren't anything to do with whether he was guilty or not. All right. So with the entire defense not permitted, there could be no cross-examine. The judge threw out the first thing. The jury did not hear the testimony, so the entire case for defense vanished. The defense had no case. These 12 guys witness, but the jury wasn't there. Judge threw it out. There's nothing. The defense had nothing. Throughout the first, you know, move, it was quashed, so the defense has nothing. Well, at this point, Meck and the journalist said the battle is over and the Genesis is completely triumphant. Many of the press packed up and left town. I don't know what day it would be when they did this. But on the seventh day, Darrow was not done. He calls William Jennings Bryan as a witness for the defense. Remember, he's a prosecuting attorney, now being called as a witness for the defense. Sometimes we call him a hostile witness, but Bryan willingly does this. Now, here's where the hubris for Bryan a little bit was. I think he didn't know what he was getting into. His counselors, others said, don't do it, and he did it anyway. So it's unusual, but Bryan is willing. The account of Darrow's interrogation of Bryan is legendary. Bryan is not sure how liberal the Bible is after all, literal the Bible is after all, and Darrow undercuts Bryan's authority by moving Bryan's Bible. He doesn't believe it in himself. So that testimony was not heard before the court either. So Bryan, in typical fashion in the testimony, tried to look erudite and biblical. The young earth was ridiculed, so he was trapped to agree with the prevailing science. It was pressure to give ages, long times in the Bible, but against the literal Bible. And Darrow saw the inconsistent, as did the press, and called his hypocrisy. Well, at this point, the Scopes changes his plea from innocent to guilty. And that effectively ends the trial. If you're going to plead guilty, what's the try? You know, Ryan never gets to cross-examine himself or explain what he meant or talk to anybody else. I mean, that was the end of it when, you know, Scopes changed his plea. So Bryan never gets to cross-examine himself or give his well-thought-out closing statement, which I said was a whole, you know, page in small print. Would take an hour. Never got to give that. Well, so what's the left to report? Well, the jurists were sequestered, but the press was not. They wrote about the only sensational thing, the performance of the biblicist, fundamentalist William Jennings Bryan. That's what they wrote about. So there's no more testimony, not even closing arguments. The guilty plea negates all courtroom drama except for the verdict. It took 9 minutes to confirm him guilty as charged. That's it. Just like, that's it? Well, the trial ended in ignominy, you might say. The $100 fine imposed by the judge was deemed a technical error because the jury should have done it. Because the jury, anything over $50, the jury must do. Small fines. Therefore, the verdict was over and turned over to the states, went to the state Supreme Court. If that's where it was turned over. There was no legal ruling, therefore, no higher appeal could be had. The Tennessee Supreme Court dismissed the whole thing, holding that nothing could be gained by prolonging the life of this bizarre case. The intention of the ACLU could not be advanced. The law stayed on the books for another 43 years. Now, a comment about the film, Inherit the Wind, was done more harm to the truth. In 2005, the Smithsonian cleared up some of the myths without recounting them here for you. Their conclusion about the trial is, ironically, the Darwin-based material Scopes taught from was not exactly pure science. According to the New Yorker Scopes textbook, calls for eliminating feeble-mindedness through eugenics. I guess that makes it not pure science. I don't know. Thus, the simple scenario of the Scopes monkey trial as pitting this evil fundamentalist fanatic against good science-based Darwinian does not hold up under scrutiny. Now, that's the Smithsonian said that. So it's kind of a neutral nothing. The United States Supreme Court later on, 1987. The Supreme Court, powerful and far-reaching opinion, notwithstanding creation science, has continued to win the approval of many Americans. This is Britannica. While teaching of evolution and its mechanisms has lagged in the public schools. I thought that was interesting. This evolution stuff just doesn't catch on. You know, you maybe teach it, but what are you going to do with it? You know, what do you do with it in college except argue about it? I mean, it doesn't make anything. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't predict anything. So you wonder why it lags. I mean, wonder why they wonder why it lags. So this was, you know, it didn't lag. For example, I remember this, 1999, that was 20 years ago, I can't remember that long ago yet, Kansas Board of Education, by narrow majority, approved a new science curriculum that eliminated the requirement of teaching evolutionary theory. Although the ruling was restricted in early 2001, it does not appear that threats to American science, this is Britannica saying this, threats to American science education will disappear anytime soon. So they consider their creationists as a threat to American science. But I don't agree with that. So there we have the trial of the century with not much to say about it. And you wonder if they would never have taken this to court, never written a law, whether they would not have been better off with it. And I think that's kind of where I end up being. So this whole trip down the side road really didn't do anybody any good and caused a lot of confusion for people and left a lot of misunderstandings amongst the people. So.